I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Hello, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a hot topic, a very important one for contemporary American life, but also one that has some historical roots, and that is energy and the environment in the United States. And I'm joined for that conversation today by Steve Hayward. Dr. Hayward is senior resident scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He has been a visiting lecturer at UC Berkeley's School of Law. He's held a number of important positions in the academic and policy world. He's been a visiting professor at the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University, where, in fact, I think he's teaching right now. He's also been a scholar at the University of Colorado and a fellow in law and economics at the American Enterprise Institute, among many other appointments that Steve has had over the years. He's also a very prolific author. Many of our listeners have probably encountered Steve's writing somewhere. Just to highlight a few, he's written a terrific book, Churchill on Leadership, a two-volume study of Ronald Reagan's presidency, one of the definitive works, really, on that very important American statesman called The Age of Reagan. And for our purposes, he's authored a book called Mere Environmentalism. So Steve is a person who's had a lot of time to think about American public policy, U.S. energy policy, and environmental policy. Delighted to have him join us on The American Idea.
Well, great to be here, Jeff. It's been a long time since we've talked.
I think if we talk about any conversation that talks about U.S. energy policy and the environment begins in a lot of popular media with the world's on fire. The environment's never been worse. It's a total disaster. We're heading right off the cliff. You, among others, I think in Bjorn Lomborg, but many others have said that have raised a question, an objection to that depiction of the state of the world environment and the American environment, air, water, and land. Maybe to set the context for our listeners, over the last 50 years, has America's air, water, and land gotten cleaner or dirtier? What's the state of the environment?
Right. Yeah, so that's a great way to open it up. I mean, I grew up with, as a kid, was the first Earth Day in 1970, because I am getting old, and, everything was terrible. The population bomb was going to make us all starve to death within 15, 20 years. That was the prediction of the famous Paul Ehrlich. We were going to run out of resources by the year 2000. Said President Jimmy Carter and lots of other experts. And none of that turned out to be true. And in the meantime, air pollution, depending on which category you look at, has fallen by as much as 90%. In a couple of categories, nearly 100%. We've eliminated airborne lead, for example, which was a good thing to do. And all the other measures of the United States and other prosperous countries have gotten dramatically better since the first Earth Day 50-some years ago. The one exception is a strange one, and that's climate change. And that's not really a matter of conventional pollution, not like, ozone or sulfur dioxide that is hazardous to your health and so forth. Carbon dioxide is supposed to be the main driver. It's something we all exhale, 800 pounds a year per person on average. So all human beings walking around are quote unquote polluters, which is absurd. But the point is that has become the issue that eats everything else alive. And I actually think it's ruining the environmental movement, but that's a separate subject. And of course, like all environmental crises of the past, it tends to be overestimated. And then the media is simply hysterical about it. And they'll usually report things that are simply not true or simply irrelevant or inaccurate.
Talk a little bit more about the ways in which water and land quality in the United States has improved. Because, for example, I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear you say in 50 years, land pollution has gotten better. They think of suburbs sprawling out and eating lots of earth. They think of unspoiled areas of the United States vanishing. Is that true?
As a general matter, no. I mean, there's several things here that you need to break apart to answer the matter in detail. But, you know, water quality is kind of hard to measure for a bunch of technical reasons that would take a little while to go through. But you can look at things like the Great Lakes. We used to worry 50 years ago that the Great Lakes were becoming the American version of the Dead Sea. You know, Lake Erie was badly polluted. So was Lake Michigan. And it turns out if you look at the data, since we started trying to crack down on industrial pollution and certain other forms of water pollution, that the Great Lakes have made a huge comeback. The level of, whether you want to look at pesticide residue, chemicals, other hazards to aquatic life, have fallen also 80-90% in the years since then. And you can now mostly fish and swim in the Great Lakes and a lot of our other major water bodies, just to take water for an example. Or as I like to joke, just up the road from you all in Ashland is the Cahoga River in Cleveland that caught fire in 1969. People know that famous story. The rivers were so bad they caught fire. You can now fish in the Cahoga River again for the first time in, the pollution of the Cahoga River actually went back to the 19th century. And once we decided that this was a problem to deal with, and by the way, Cleveland thought about dealing with the problem themselves long before the federal government stepped in. So the remediation of the waterways in Ohio and other places in the upper Midwest is a long-term story, often instigated by local governments and local communities before Washington decided to go and save the planet for us.
Is it true that at the same time, I was looking at this statistic, that while many indicators of environmental quality in air, water, and land have improved, United States population, of course, has grown, and United States energy consumption has grown fairly dramatically over 50 years. I think a lot of people will be surprised because they assume that energy consumption, production and consumption must mean more pollution.
Right.
Why hasn't it?
Yeah, well, first of all, we've gotten so much better on technical means of reducing pollution from essentially fuel combustion. And we've done a lot of fuel switching, switching from coal. Well, first of all, there's ways of controlling pollution from coal-fired power plants, and we've mostly done that everywhere. We also switched to natural gas, which is a much cleaner burning fuel for electricity generation and other things. We've gotten a lot more energy efficient. It's true that our energy consumption has gone up. But our energy intensity, that's to say how much energy we use per person or per dollar of economic output, has fallen dramatically. And the last time I did a calculation, which was a few years ago, and I'll bet it's even better now, is that if the United States had the same energy intensity that it had in 1970, our energy consumption would be about 2.5 times what it is today. That's a really dramatic improvement. It's also very long-term. We generally get more efficient at a small rate every year, going back more than a century. And nobody knows these stories because they're small, they're incremental. And again, you have the people who have an interest in hysteria, namely environmental advocacy groups and the news media, that either conceal or don't even understand these trends and what they mean.
Can you talk a little bit more? That's really fascinating that, as you say, we consume less energy per person now than we used to by dramatic. What are some of the most important drivers of this really important efficiency?
Well, one was, higher costs actually have a lot to do with it. Back in the 70s, suddenly oil got scarce and more expensive very fast. And that led industry and American consumers to decide they wanted to, in the case of consumers, swap out their low mileage cars for cars that got better gas mileage. That's what a lot of individuals did. Industry decided that, look, if we can save money by being more efficient, we should do that because it's good for the bottom line. In other words, they didn't really need regulation or hectoring from the government. People adjusted spontaneously to a higher cost environment. We can set aside to later whether oil is actually scarce or not. There's more of a political problem than an actual market problem there. But that was one of the reasons. And then again, pollution standards had something to do with this because oftentimes the answer to lowering air pollution and other kinds of pollution was simply a more efficient industrial operation. So, chemical plants that used to 75 years ago, not pay close attention to their industrial waste, decided they wanted to go to what we call now in general a closed loop system where there's no waste at all. And that involves a lot of energy and resource efficiency. And so not only do we use less energy, but we use natural resources and raw materials a lot more efficiently than we ever did.
You mentioned that issue of scarcity of natural resources. Again, I think something that 50 years ago, you've mentioned already, Paul Ehrlich and others, but doomsday, that there's no way we can sustain a modern economic system and a market system and a high quality of life and consumption with the resources that we have. We're going to run out of oil. We're going to run out of all other energy. We're going to run out of land. We're going to run out of there's going to be mass starvation. Like, I think maybe people have forgotten the doomsday predictions of 50 years ago. But what about that? Are natural resources in the United States getting scarcer?
Well, they may be in the United States for political reasons. In other words, it's very difficult to open a new mine in this country. But that does not mean that resources themselves are scarce, either on the national or global scale. I think the first prediction that we were going to run out of oil was made, if I remember this right, in 1895 by the U.S. Geological Survey. And so that's a long time ago now.
Right?
And actually, as recently as 20 years ago, we were told that we had finally reached the era of peak oil. And the United States, you might remember, to put it in partisan terms, that Democrats like to say, we can't drill our way out of oil dependency on foreign nations. Except that within a few years, we did drill our way out, mostly on private land. That's a longer story about overregulation. But now the United States is once again the world's leading oil producer, having nearly doubled our domestic output over the last 15, 20 years. That's mostly a technology story. But you can generalize that across the board for all important natural resources. I think, you know, copper, lithium right now, of course, is a very highly prized raw material for electric batteries, for everything we're trying to electrify. And, you know, the worry here just 3 or 4 years ago is, gosh, we don't have enough lithium for everything we think we want to do. And it turns out that we're now looking around harder to find lithium. And guess what? There's a lot more around than we thought there was. There's now, consistent price and market for it. And my guess is lithium's not going to be the limiting constraint on the electrification of the world. That's a separate question about whether the electrification of everything makes sense. But if that's what the world wants to do, resource constraints are not going to be the primary problem.
Well, why do people make that mistake? And they seem to have made it fairly consistently over the last 50 years, right, saying we're going to run out of oil, we're going to run out of energy, we're going to run out of lithium. What's the mindset, as you've studied this, that makes people come to that wrong judgment?
Yeah, well, I think there are two reasons that may overlap. One is, look, the natural human condition is scarcity. I mean, that's the basic story of economics itself is scarcity and how you manage scarcity, because our wants and needs tend to be unlimited. Our wants certainly are unlimited. And so it's natural to think you might run out of something. But the second one, I think, is more important sort of psychologically and philosophically. I'm sometimes asked, you know, why are environmentalists unhappy when you tell them good news? And no, it really is true. If you actually show the data to certain kinds of environmentalists that air pollution is falling and environmental conditions are improving in most parts of the world, they're outraged. And the reason is, I think that a lot of popular environmentalism is a substitute for what used to be the religious version of the apocalypse or the end times. In other words, you know, believing that the world is coming to an end is a secular religion for environmentalists. And, you know, it makes them happy to believe that not only is the world coming to an end, but their creed, you know, their efforts are what are going to save the planet and therefore save humanity. So it's a religious substitute. I used to resist that point of view, but it's harder and harder all the time when you listen to a lot of environmental leaders talk about the matter, not to mention the activists who, in most cases, are completely untethered from reality and from data and science. And it's pretty clear that what drives this is not actual facts, but is something deeper and really more pathetic. I'll put it that way. I'll be very pungent and straightforward about it. It's really quite, you know, why did Time magazine make Greta Thunberg their person of the year 3 or 4 years back? She's a teenager. What does she, and, you know, world leaders want to meet her. They want to meet a teenager. What do they have to learn from a teenager? I mean, this is embarrassing for any person in a responsible role in government or anywhere to say, oh, we're going to take our cues from a Swedish teenager.
Let's talk a little bit about, and something you've studied, which is U.S. energy policy. across the board, what's the state of U.S. energy policy?
I shouldn't laugh.
I didn't mean to.
right. Especially since I've got a cough going. It's been a confused mess for decades, often at war with itself, or contradictory. I guess what you'd say right now is, and I made reference to this already, is the orthodoxy now is so hostile to what we call fossil fuels, you know, coal, gas, and oil, that we think we need to electrify everything, our cars, our transportation, beside from cars, you know, trains, buses, even airplanes somehow. The problem with that is you'll have to greatly increase the supply of electricity to charge your electric cars and everything else. And the problem with that is we still generate most of our electricity in this country from fossil fuels, principally coal and natural gas. Nuclear may make a comeback, and it certainly should, I think. The problem is nobody's thought through the resource requirements of this to the extent that it's necessary. And then the second thing is there's a purism to it, and it really does derive from the hatred of fossil fuels. So let's take just electric cars for a moment. Right now, the push is to get us all to drive all electric cars out here in California, where I am, within, I guess, 13 years, a little more than 10 years, we're supposed to have an all-electric car fleet for sale. In other words, they want to ban conventional gasoline-powered engines in California 11 years from now. And, you know, to suppose that electric vehicles, with all of their limitations of charging times and various other things, are going to replace the flexibility of gasoline-powered cars is a real fantasy, and I think it won't happen. However, here's the thing. You know, we do have a technology, and you can find some hybrid electric models. They have a smaller battery, so less raw materials for a battery. They have about a 50-mile range on electric charge, and then the gasoline engine will kick in. And so the point is, if you instead of trying to have purely all electric cars, we encourage the auto industry, or allow the auto industry, to simply make hybrid electric cars as an option for consumers who want them, you would get a vast reduction in the consumption of gasoline and fossil fuels, a vast reduction in conventional air pollution and carbon dioxide emissions. But that's not good enough for the environmentalists. They so hate fossil fuels that they refuse to extend any of the tax credits, any of the subsidies for the production and distribution of hybrid electric cars. That's the kind of purism that's actually hurting their cause. And I'll add one more thing. Right now, we are building wind and solar power everywhere. I think there's reasons to be very critical of those sources because of their intermittency. But regardless of that, one problem that the Biden administration was aware of but ignored, the permit process and the regulatory process for doing that is still very kludgy, as I think we might say. And so even environmentalists are starting to wake up, like the Washington Post recently in their editorial page said, look, all this wind and solar power is not going to amount to anything if we can't modernize the grid. And we can't modernize the grid with today's regulatory structure. And the answer from people on the left in Congress has been, no, we don't want to change our regulatory structure. And so, you know, the environmentalists can't get out of their own way.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
You mentioned other types of American fuel, like, for example, natural gas, which seems, if I'm right, to be a much cleaner fuel in many ways and produce a lot of energy per unit. What has been, if you just to take that as an example, what has U.S. energy policy been toward natural gas?
Well, the good news is there hasn't been a policy about natural gas, with the exception of pipelines, which we can come back to. But on the production side, keep in mind that if you go back to 20 years ago, almost exactly 20 years ago, natural gas was selling between $12 and $14 a thousand cubic feet. And all the projections were that by the year 2020, which is now in our rearview mirror, the U.S. would not be able to produce enough natural gas by itself, and we'd have to import probably 25% of our natural gas needs from guess where? The Middle East, where natural gas was selling for $1 a thousand cubic feet in Qatar and the other Gulf states. Well, guess what? All of a sudden, a technological revolution came along. Fracking, as we typically call it, was not a new technology, but combined with much better underground directional drilling technology to be able to go different directions deep underground, and better methods of finding pockets of gas and oil, revolutionized the industry. And it did it almost overnight, at least in our usual timescales. And it happened quietly on private land in places like Eastern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, Texas, the Dakotas, and so forth. And I like to joke, except it's not really a joke, is that if people in Washington, D.C. had known that this revolution was taking place, they surely would have done something to stop it. And so we've gone in the space of 20 years from a shortage of natural gas and high prices, $14, I said, a thousand cubic feet, to where today we can become the largest exporter of natural gas in the world, or one of the largest ones. And the gas industry worries that the price is so low, their profitability is threatened, because now gas struggles to stay above $2 a thousand cubic feet, down from 14, 20 years ago. That's pretty dramatic. It's hard to think of any other major product that's had that kind of price drop and production increase in the last 100 years. But there it is. And like I say, it's one of the great fortunate stories, again, driven by American entrepreneurs and technological development. And Washington had very little to do with it. And like I say, they would have stopped it if they knew it was happening.
I think some of our listeners hear a story like that and they say, but then they look at their own prices for gas at the pump and they say, okay, so something like natural gas has got, production's gone up, prices have gone down. If we can get electricity out of natural gas or use it otherwise, that sounds absolutely terrific. But I've got a gas-powered car, and man, gas is really expensive, even here in Ohio, much less California.
I'm not going to tell you about our gas prices.
Are thinking, if this is true, what you're saying, Steve, why are gas prices so high?
Yeah, well, I'll say two things. One is a large portion of it, certainly where I live in California, where we have an almost $1.50 to $2 a gallon premium over the average U.S. price. It's driven by regulations, high taxes in some states. It varies a lot from state to state. And the other thing, though, is that if you strip out all these artificial things of taxes and regulation and some market volatility, which is worth talking about, you'll find that the price of gas adjusted for inflation is not that much higher than it was 50-some years ago. In other words, it's crept up along with the price level. From time to time, we have enjoyed really low gasoline prices, not for a while now, but back around 2000, gas actually dipped below $1 a gallon, which it hadn't seen since really the early 80s. After the financial crisis in 2008, gasoline dipped quite a bit. The problem is oil is priced internationally, unlike natural gas, which is more of a local price. And when Russia reduces production and when the Arab countries reduce production, it does tend to have a spike in prices. Those price oscillations have gone down some since the United States increased its oil production here in the last decade. But we're still at a little bit at the mercy of an international oil market. That's one problem. The other problem is most people who drive up to the pump, what means all of us, we see three grades of gasoline. We see, basic, unleaded, mid-grade, and premium. And we think, we have three kinds of gasoline depending on octane level and what kind of engine you have, supposedly. Well, it turns out that in the United States, we have over 80 kinds of gasoline, 80. And you're like, what are you talking about? What can that mean? Well, it turns out that for regulatory reasons, stretching back to the original Clean Air Act, We have a lot of very special blends for localized atmospheric conditions, especially in California. But also, I suspect, I'm not familiar with Ohio, but I suspect you have some special blending requirements for Ohio that kick in the summer. I won't go through some of the technical aspects, but all of those special blends of gasoline that we use for environmental reasons increase the price of gasoline. If we just had three kinds of gasoline for the whole country, you know, I'm not sure what the estimates are, but it would take, 15, 20, 30, maybe 50% off the 50 cents, sorry, off the cost of a gallon of gas. But that's something that also people almost know nothing about. And I'll add finally, although it's a long story, is that most of those special blending regulations are by now obsolete. They might have made sense in 1990. They really don't make sense anymore. But, the environmental regulators hate to let go of a regulatory regime.
So if you're thinking about, you've studied this, and you're thinking about, I know we can't wave magic wands, especially in energy policy, where there's a lot of complicated patchwork of state legislation. There's, of course, congressional legislation. There's federal regulatory agencies, all of which, as you're pointing out, have all kinds of regulations and input into this. But if Steve Hayward could wave a magic wand and implement two or three or four of the most important reforms in U.S. energy policy, and you say, okay, if we do these things, we're going to maintain a cleaner environment. What we're also going to have affordable, reliable energy for ourselves, for our lives, and for our economy, for a modern economy. What would some of those most important reforms be?
One of them would be energy infrastructure of all kinds. I mentioned the grid already, but also pipelines. We have this bounty of natural gas, but lots of opposition to building new pipelines to move it around where it could do a lot of good, like the Northeast, where New York has been blocking new pipelines for a long time. I'll mention, by the way, this hostility to pipelines. You may remember that on day one of the Biden administration, the president canceled the Keystone XL pipeline that was under construction. And I still don't quite understand the legal authority for doing that, because it was a privately funded, privately built project with a federal permit, and the permit was revoked. See, and that's what I don't understand. It's one thing for government to say, we're not going to give you a pipeline for something. That happens all the time. I do not know of any instance in American history where a president or an administration canceled a previously permitted project that was already under construction by the private sector and threw thousands of workers out of their jobs instantly. I don't think that's ever happened before. And it's amazing that has escaped comment. But we need to have the flexibility for energy supplies to move around. The second thing I'd do, in addition to simply allowing more infrastructure, we really do need to think harder about how to update the whole world of nuclear power. And I'm not a super expert about nuclear power, but there are a lot of new designs under research and development. And, we still have a Nuclear Regulatory Commission with something like 6,000 employees, and I'm not quite sure what they do except collect reports and read them over. And supposedly the newest draft guidelines for new generations of nuclear power make it harder to build them instead of easier. There's no reason why, there's really no evidence that I can think of why our nuclear power plants are less safe than the ones that have been built around the world, and generally much cheaper than ours and much more quickly than ours. We have the stupidest and most cumbersome regulatory process in the world for building nuclear power. And, reason for that to persist.
About that? Sure. Because that seems like a really interesting point. If you think of European countries or Japan, I think of France, for example, a lot of countries have an astonishing percentage of their energy is produced by nuclear power. Why is it so much lower? Take a little bit more time to explain. Why is it so much lower in the United States than in other developed countries around the world?
Oh, there's a whole lot of reasons, but France is the best example. They went from almost no nuclear power, I'm going to say 1970. They might have had one or two. I'm sure they did for actual nuclear weapons purposes. But then when the oil crisis hit, and France used to generate a lot of its electricity with oil. We used to generate 20% of our electricity from oil back in the 70s. Today, that number is essentially zero. Here and there, there's an old oil-fired power plant that's used as backup for emergency situations. But So France was importing a ton of oil, and suddenly they said it's going to be cheaper if we go big with nuclear power. So in the space of about a decade and a half, France built, I think the number is around 70 nuclear reactors. During that same period, we finished building four or five and started no new ones. And so, you know, today France gets almost 80% of its electricity from nuclear power. We get about 18% now, I think. It used to be 20. That number may be falling down a little bit here. But the point is, I like to tell this to environmentalists, some of whom will quietly admit that opposing nuclear power 40 years ago was a great mistake on their part. But if we had continued building nuclear power at the same rate that France did, today we would have one of the lowest carbon footprints for electricity in the entire world, like France does. And it was environmentalists who opposed nuclear power and had endless lawsuits, always lobbied for more cumbersome regulations to make it unaffordable to build nuclear power. The utility industry, for reasons I think are quite sensible, gave up on the whole idea about 40 years ago because they could see that it was going to be so expensive to build nuclear power plants that it made more sense to just keep using natural gas and coal. So we shot ourselves in the head on nuclear power, and now we're trying to play catch up. And the problem is, or one problem is, not only have we not updated our regulatory structure, but we've now kind of lost what you might say is the expertise and the skill building that you have. You know, we're short of nuclear engineers and have to play catch up just on the level of talent to, you know, build and operate and innovate in the nuclear energy area.
So you've mentioned we need to update our energy infrastructure, things like the grid and pipelines. You've mentioned updating the regulatory structure for nuclear power and growing talent. Are there any other reforms that you think are really important?
Well, this is a little off in the weeds, but we ought to harmonize or level out our subsidy schemes. You know, one problem right now is that certain kinds of energy are favored in our tax code or with direct subsidies, like wind power in particular. You know, other forms like actually nuclear power, but certainly conventional electricity generation, are not favored. And so you have an unlevel playing field. The simplistic example, but right now, if I own some windmills, and a lot of windmills are owned by private partnerships, not by the utility companies, and they get to sell their power every day into the grid on the spot market. But you know, wind power enjoys a production tax credit. The government pays you, I forget what it is, but it's a substantial amount of money. I can actually bid to sell you power at a negative rate. In other words, I can sell you power for minus a dollar, whatever the unit might be, and I'll still make money because of the production tax credit the government provides. That tilts the playing field in the marketplace to wind power. And you know, how do you compete with that if you're a gas-fired power plant and you don't have that? So we ought to levelize out all the subsidies and disparate tax treatments that we have for each form of energy and make it level. And by the way, over the last 20 years, the production tax credit would expire. They were always enacted on a temporary basis, 2-3 years, something like that. We've been saying since the 70s we needed to help an infant industry get going. And every time that happens, windmill construction stops. People simply stop building them because they only make sense with the favorable tax treatment. So we really need to get rid of that kind of thing and allow wind and solar power to compete on an equal basis with natural gas and so forth.
Yeah, that's a question I have because you've done a lot of work in sort of bringing market forces into U.S. energy policy. And that seems to be one area you're talking about. There seems to be a lot of what some people call crony capitalism.
Oh, yeah.
U.S. energy policy. Are there other examples that you can think of that come to mind in terms of reforms like that?
I think as a general matter, quite beyond the energy area, we ought to make our regulatory processes for building anything a lot more simple. So it's hard to, I mean, another great example. Out here in California, we're trying to build high-speed rail. Now, I think it's a dumb idea here, and it really doesn't make any sense. But nonetheless, it's taking forever and costing 4 to 5 times as much as projected. And most of that is simply process cost. It's not the difficulty of the engineering and so forth. And even the New York Times noticed this, I don't know, a year or two ago, because, you know, we invited in some of the overseas countries that have been pretty good at building high-speed rail, like the French. And they came and they took a look and they said, you Americans are crazy how much process you put on all these kinds of things. They said, we're going to go work on high-speed rail in Morocco instead. Well, guess what? Morocco has finished its high-speed rail program in the same time that we're still dithering around about building the first 100 miles out here in California. That is repeated across our economy now. It's not even strong enough to say that the barnacles of our regulatory process are now everywhere. It's worse than that. And, you know, the problem is we're a rich country and it seems like we can afford a lot of waste in our regulatory process, but I think we really can't anymore.
Yeah, and it seems like that California high-speed rail project has now engendered opposition across the political spectrum.
You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to know that we were being lied to, 15 years ago now. And they said, oh, it'll cost $35 billion. Now the cost is north of $100 billion. And no one thinks it's really going to get finished. The problem is that you have to go through a whole lot of mountains with lots of earthquake faults to get all the way to Los Angeles. And there are similar problems in the Bay Area. So you're going to build a couple hundred miles in the Central Valley, and that's going to be it. And not that many people live in the Central Valley. I mean, you want to talk about a costly white elephant. This is it.
Looking toward the future, Steve, what do you see as the future state of energy and the environment in the United States if we look 2 or 3 decades now into the future? What are some important trends that our listeners should be looking for?
First of all, I tend to be generally an optimist in thinking that human ingenuity and innovation and creativity can outrun even the stupidest regulators. Yeah,
you know, that's a lot of optimism.
Yeah, it is. Well, I mean, I guess I'll put it this way. An environmentalist wouldn't think this is optimistic at all, but we're still going to be using quite a bit of oil and gas and probably even some coal, too, 20-30 years from now. This idea that we're going to get to, I'll set aside right now what net zero actually means and why it's actually a fraudulent term. But the point is that traditional fossil fuels simply have too much superiority over the alternatives. That's why they're not going to go away anytime soon. And I think they exist in abundance. I think the fracking revolution has just gotten started on a global basis. It's reasonably mature in this country, but not at all used in a lot of parts of the world where there's surely lots more oil and gas to be produced when we need it and the price justifies it. And we're going to get better. I mean, already, just to mention one thing about going back to air pollution. Most people don't know that we've reduced conventional tailpipe air pollution from cars by like 95% from 50 years ago. That's a technological story. That's one of the greater success stories, partly driven by markets, partly driven by regulation. And I think more of that is going to go along. And the other thing that I think is going to happen is my own opinion without going into details is that, you know, the climate change story is true, but almost certainly overestimated. By 3 or 4 times what it's likely to be, even under the projections of the models and so forth. And so what that means is I think within 20 or 30 years, like the population bomb, like resource exhaustion and so forth, we're going to look at climate change as a much less severe phenomenon than the way it's treated today by the advocates and media. And that means we're going to wonder what all the hysteria has been about as it is right now. And we're also going to think about other means of dealing with the problems that do arise, which are not apocalyptic. I'll just mention here that all the things you hear about, you know, millions of people are going to die, the sea levels are going to flood us out. If you actually read the UN reports, you find no scientific evidence in favor of most of the popular claims of how we're all going to come to ruin in 50 or 100 years. And sooner or later, the truth is going to catch up with all of that. And when it does, the world will look different than it does today.
Well, hopefully in 20 years, we'll be back on this podcast and we'll be able to check those predictions.
Right. Well, I was right, 20 years ago that the whole peak oil, peak gas business was wrong. And that, in fact, if we got after it, we'd find that there was an abundance of it. And that's turned out to be completely true.
Well, you've certainly given us some really interesting things to think about today on energy and the environment in the United States. Steve Hayward, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thanks, Jeff. Go Ashbrook.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.